When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
If there's a race and we're all lined up together and everybody on that line has the same experiences, the same capabilities, it's all the same, except on me, I'm wearing a backpack. And in my backpack, I carry being African-American in a country where that's been an unequal environment for a very long time, 400 years to be exact. I carry my bag that I'm a woman, so I might have kids back there, I might have whatever. But if I have to run my race and still be as fast or faster than everybody else in the line who doesn't carry the backpack, weigh them down. So always try to listen and understand who's got a backpack and try to lighten the backpack whenever I could. You can only do so much. Everybody's got to do their part.
Welcome to Modern Minorities.
This is a show about work and life told through the lens of what makes each of us different.
I'm Sharon Lee Tony, a Chinese American girl born and raised in New York City.
And I'm Raman Segal, an Indian American boy who came from Alabama with a banjo on my knee.
Through conversations with some really interesting people, we uncover the stories, perspectives, and often unspoken truths about how our guests uniquely experience the world.
It doesn't matter where you're from, the color of your skin, or who you love. We're all minorities somehow, but we're no one's model minority.
This is a show about all of you, for all of us.
On today's show for Black History Month, we're featuring a chat with Linda Clement Holmes, P&G's former Chief Diversity Officer and Chief Information Officer. This is actually a conversation from my other podcast, Learnings from Leaders, where we have candid mentorship-style conversations with business leaders, entrepreneurs, and philanthropists, most of whom are alums of the Procter & Gamble Company, where many of my friends and I got our careers started. It's a show featuring candid mentorship-style chats for the next generation of leaders. Here's a quick bio about Linda. Linda Clement Holmes has led a career as a global executive of firsts across several disciplines. She was the first female African-American senior vice president and then president at Procter & Gamble. Most recently, she was P&G's chief diversity officer, significantly elevating the company's standing in the space of diversity and inclusion, crafting the first company-wide diversity and inclusion strategy, and establishing P&G's first ever Global Inclusion and Diversity Council. Linda was also P&G's chief information officer, leading everything from infrastructure to innovation, having risen to the C-suite after starting as a systems analyst way back when in the 80s. Linda's been widely recognized for her leadership and business acumen, having been named American Business Awards Female Executive of the Year, Black Enterprise Magazine's Top Executive, Working Mother's Working Mother of the Year, and one of Computer World's Premier 100 IT Leaders, among many, many other honors. Linda's an active board leader among many community business and service organizations and holds a degree in industrial management and computer science from Purdue University. She also happens to be a mother of two accomplished sons, who she's really proud of. So let's dive right in. We hope you'll enjoy our conversation with Linda. Linda, welcome to the podcast. It's really great to have you here.
Thank you so much.
So Linda, a lot of people know your professional story, P&G's chief diversity officer serving on the company's global leadership council, where you crafted the company's first company-wide diversity and inclusion strategy, established P&G's first ever global inclusion diversity council, frankly, significantly elevating P&G's standing in this D&I space. But you were also P&G's CIO, leading everything from infrastructure to innovation, having risen to the C-suite from starting as a systems analyst in 1983. And through your career, you became this global executive of first across many disciplines at the company as the first African-American senior vice president and later president. But as someone in the organization during your tenure, I think your reputation in the work speaks for itself. So there's so much I want to pick your brain on. But first, who were you before the career journey, before you were a systems analyst in 1983. Can you tell us a story from your childhood?
You make it sound so long ago, and it feels like it's so long ago sometimes now. Probably the thing that I reflect back most on is that I actually started working when I was 12, and I was a dance teacher, believe it or not, and that was a dance teacher for two-year-olds. So the backstory is I grew up in Gary, Indiana, and I grew up, and I say grew up sort of loosely, in a dance studio. So when I wasn't at school, I was a cheerleader in high school, when I wasn't doing that or was in band or whatever, I was at the dance studio, and I was at the dance studio a lot. And the owner was like a second mother to me and to all of us. And she took the time to not only teach us dance lessons, but she taught us life lessons. So she instilled a work ethic that I think really impacted me the rest of my life. And so, like I said, I started teaching at 12. Most of us did. If we had grown up in that studio. And I actually began working as the office receptionist at 15. So I learned how to deal with people and to be responsible. And to be responsible for taking in money that wasn't mine, that was the company's money, and so forth. So I learned a lot at a very young age. And I owe a lot, I think, to her for spending that time with me and with all of us as we were growing up.
So back then, who'd you imagine you'd become working in that dance studio? What did that make you want to do when you grow up?
Well, for a hot second, I wanted to be a ballerina. for a hot second. But I knew that wasn't probably going to be likely. It's interesting. I don't know that I ever had I want to be an astronaut or whatever. I know what I didn't say. I never said I wanted to be chief diversity officer. I didn't grow up saying that. But, you know, I think when I was headed to college and growing up, I grew up in a household that was actually tech savvy, believe it or not, even back then. And you're talking about growing up in the 70s and late 60s, my parents, both of my parents were into tech, whatever that meant at the time. We had the first Betamax. You can find these things in the Smithsonian now. So it was sort of the predecessor to VHS, the videotapes. And we had the one of the first ones, and it took up half the table in the kitchen. It was so big. And my dad passed away when I was 14, but my dad was very into audiovisual things. He took lots of pictures. He was a photographer. He had lots of different interests. But both my mom and my dad never shied away from things that were new and different, even back then. And so when I went to college, for me, it was all about how much tech can I get my hands on.
Is there something that you learned with that tech, or once you got to college, what did that kind of spur in you?
Well, when I went to college, you have to remember back then there were no cell phones, there was no internet, there was no PCs, there was no email, there was none of that. So I went to college thinking I want to be an animator. That's actually what I was originally going in for, to be
like a Disney animator or something,
right,
like that.
Exactly. Oh, loved it. Loved it. Loved it. Just the thought of it was just,
that's so cool.
And doing that with technology was all what I was really fascinated about. But I also didn't know a lot about the field, to be honest. And I went to Purdue University, and when I enrolled, I actually enrolled in the engineering school. But before I even got there, I actually switched schools before I even got there, because there was a professor at Purdue that had a program called the Business Opportunity Program, and he would come to your house and talk to you and your parents and so forth about the program. But it was in the business school at Purdue in Craner. And this program meant you had to be in the business school and not in the engineering school, but it gave you a start that first summer. So I graduated from high school, I think, on a Thursday, and I was at Purdue on Monday, literally 3 days later. And it was there that my eyes kind of opened up into the world being bigger than what I thought. But I was able to get a jump start on college, but also be able to marry being in the business school with my technology side. So my undergrad could still be in computer science, which I was thrilled about. So it allowed me to understand that, you know what, technology and computers can do more than just my little world and my little mind thought of just of animation. And how much bigger than that than it really was. And that sort of started this journey that led me to P&G eventually. But that's sort of how it started.
You know, it's funny, when I came up as a computer engineer, I remember trying to explain to my folks that this isn't a niche thing. This isn't about the printer or the computer. The whole world is going to go in this direction. And I don't think I won that argument back in the 80s and 90s, but it was... I did now, I guess.
And it was fascinating. Like I said, my parents were always, they never shied away from it. And I remember my mom was a teacher, and after I graduated from college or whatever, and that's sort of when the PC, the Apple, the original first Apple came along. My mom didn't shy. She had some of the first ones and so forth. And she actually took on a job where she was teaching other teachers about computers. And in her bedroom, she must have had four or five PCs. Now, only four of them worked, if it was five of them, but they're all there. But I think again, she saw the benefit really early on. And I think as a family, like I said, there was no shy away from the things that are innovative and new from a technical standpoint. And I think you're right. And I think a lot of us may have seen that early in terms of the role that technology could play. But it took a while for the rest of the world to sort of get that, some that if that wasn't in your blood like it is for a lot of us.
Yeah, until the practical use cases in your everyday life versus that big clunky machine in the corner.
Right, right, right.
So I want to fast forward a few years to your career starting at P&G. Can you tell me about an early career moment, some early lessons that you learned when you were starting out?
Probably one of the things that was most impactful. I grew up, I was very quiet, not necessarily shy, but quiet. So I didn't talk a lot. I talked when I had something to say, pretty much still do that to some degree. I probably talk a whole lot more now, but I was very quiet. And at the same time, I also remember in the field of technology, you have to think about, this was 35, 37 years ago. There weren't that many women in the field and there weren't that many people of color at all in the field. Mm-hmm. So right. Often I was the only whatever, woman, person of color, whatever. And if I go to a conference, that might be 500,000 people and I might be one of one or two or whatever. So to have confidence in that setting is really, really tough. So my self-confidence wasn't very high at all when it came to my technical knowledge and so forth. So I always thought everybody else knows more than I do. And when I first started, I think it was my second assignment at P&G, I had to deal a lot with vendors. And a lot with vendors who were doing a lot around innovation and things like this. This was back in my first sort of interactions with Silicon Valley and things like that.
Right, right.
I remember thinking, oh, how overwhelmed I was and how much more they knew. And I had a vendor say to me, make some comment to me about what I didn't know or whatever. And that really sort of took me aback. And I thought about it and I think I talked to some people and it dawned on me, wait a minute, I'm a customer. No, it's not okay. And it dawned on me at that point that it doesn't matter that what you know or don't, or you think you know more than me. At the end of the day, it's my decision that matters. And it turned the tables. And then my confidence all of a sudden switched on where it hadn't been before. And that it was okay to ask questions, that it's okay that you don't know because it's not possible to know everything, that it's okay that there is somebody else in the room who knows more than you. That's actually a good thing, right? But it's okay to ask them questions, or it's okay to say, what are you talking about? I don't understand that. And that was a hard learning for me at first, because I kind of felt like I'm supposed to know everything.
Yeah, it's kind of this humility and seeking to understand. I remember as a young digital manager, that exact thing, realizing, yeah, I am the customer, but this guy probably knows more. And it's my job to learn as much as I can from him for the advantage of whatever my agenda is, right? For the company, for the project I'm working on, et cetera. But right. It's kind of, I think they started calling it seek to understand as much as possible.
Yeah.
So is there anything in your career that didn't quite work out the way you thought it would?
Oh, there's lots of things. Not time for all that. Probably one of the biggest ones is probably one of the later ones. And it's one that didn't work out the way I wanted to, but I'm okay with that because I learned a lot. I think at the end of the day, one of the things I've always tried to do in the latter half, I'll call it, of my career in particular, is to really be really clear about what I control, what I don't control, what I have influence over, and the things that I don't control, and to be okay with that. And what happened was, and you'll probably remember this, was this was early on as we were starting our move to the cloud at P&G. And one of the things that I pushed really hard for was us to move to Google. And I felt really strongly that it would be a leapfrog for us. And I had a lot of support for that idea and so forth. And we did a lot of work. All the tests went really well. But at the end of the day, our CEO at the time, David Taylor, decided there were too many other things. He had just become CEO. There were too many other things that the business and the company needed to do first and couldn't handle that move at the time. So I totally understood that from a business standpoint. So it didn't work out the way I wanted. I learned a lot along the way. At the same time, I felt good about standing up for what I believed was to be true and what I felt was right. But then end of the day, knew that that decision was his decision. And that's the one I needed support at this point. So sometimes that's what happens when your career is at it may not be the decision you want, but it's the decision that was made, and that's the one you need to support.
So Linda, along the way, also, a lot of our listeners are kind of mid-career professionals, and sometimes we feel we're not keeping up, meeting up to the expectations. Did you ever have some of those moments? And more importantly, how did you persevere? How did you kind of push through those moments?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, because a lot of times you may feel like, am I doing well enough, and so forth. And one of the things that I always tell people, and I always try to do is, first of all, if you've had a conversation with your boss, your manager, about what's most important, are you really crystal clear about what that is? And if you do that, do those things first, then everything else will either take care of itself, or you have to do later or whatever. But you have to be clear about what's important. So when you're having this feeling about I can't keep up, well, is it because you're trying to do too much, maybe? Is it that you're focused on the wrong things? I mean, what is it? But that's what your manager is there for, right? Is to have that conversation with, okay, there's a lot going on, but let me tell you, here's the things that I think are important. Are these the right things, or whatever? Have that sort of expectation exchange with your manager. And that's what you should focus on and deliver that. Then you'll get that done and move on to other things. You'll feel much better and have more confidence about what you're doing. But I really think that's important. A lot of times people don't do that. And instead, they may spend time on things that maybe aren't as important. And that's where that feeling, I think, sometimes comes from.
So all of us face these career forks in the road, the inflection points where these big decisions set us on a path. Were there any of those moments for you?
Yeah, probably. Well, there's several. So I always say there's three big ones in my career that were turning points for me for one reason or another. So I think the first one was, and I think in chunks of years, I don't think in the actual year for some reason, but anyway, but the first one was around 2000 to 2001 when we did the outsourcing of IT services to HP. That was a real defining moment in terms of, for me, because before that we were going through a whole process to outsource a lot of services to EDS, and it didn't go through at the last minute. And I was on the side to be outsourced at that point. And then I switched to the other side of leading the outsourcing. And having been on the side before, I knew what that felt like.
Yeah, it caused a lot of anxiety in the organization.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And having lived through that for 18 months, not knowing what your future is, not knowing a whole lot of things, I was determined when I got to the other side to not put people through that, because I knew what that felt like. So I was determined to get people answers as soon as possible. I was, when we were going to go dark, we told them we were going to go dark for how long, and this is the kind of things we're going to be working on, so that they, as much as possible, we could be transparent. So they would try to make, they had the ability to make whatever life decisions they needed to make. And that was really, really important to me. So that was the first one. The second one was being chief diversity officer. That was a very eye-opening and very different experience for me. I kind of went into that thing, okay, I'm a Black woman. I got this. I had no idea what I didn't know. Okay, so that was sort of the second one. I learned a phenomenal amount that I didn't know and I thought I did. And I met people I'd never would have met before. And then the third one is probably when I lived in Europe. And that experience in and of itself was a turning point for me just in terms of how I led. I found a different voice, I think I'll say, coming out of that experience as well. So those are the three defining moments. And then I'll say sort of overall, one of the things that my late husband and I would do often and every year is write down together what was important, because those things change over time. And that was important for our family. It was important from a career standpoint and everything. And revisit that every year and do it when we weren't faced with some decision. Because when you're faced with a decision, the pressure and stress of whatever that is sort of overshadows everything. And you may make a decision based on the stress versus really what's important.
The principle. Exactly.
So if you look at what's important when you're not under stress of a decision, the clarity of it is much better, so that when those opportunities come along, it may not make the decision easy, but it probably will make it easier. And that's what I've always found.
So can you talk to me about mentorship? Who are the folks along the way that you've kind of sought guidance from? And what are the sort of behaviors and things you learned from them?
Two come to mind. I was fortunate to have lots of mentors over the years, but the two probably really early ones that come to mind was Juanita Simmons. Juanita was the first African-American woman who made it to associate director in IT. and then Robert Scott. And then Robert Scott was first African-American to make it to vice president and in IT. And both of them for very different reasons. One of the things I learned from Juanita, and kind of back to that point around, if somebody else is more technical than you and they know more than you, and people know me, know I'm vertically challenged. I'm not very tall. Juanita taught me, and watching her said, you know what? Size doesn't matter, literally. And I saw her in a conversation with someone who was extraordinarily technical, and who had a mentality of, because I know everything and I'm technical, that means that the rest of you know nothing. And I saw her point a very, very well manicured finger across the table and put him in his place. I said, that's the best thing ever. And I learned about, you know what? It's not about that. It's about, if that's the role you're playing, then that's the role I'm playing. Then it doesn't matter what or who you think you are. If it's my responsibility to be in this role as this, then that's what I'm going to do. And I saw that from her, and I loved that about her. Robert Scott, who still is a very good friend, actually now to this day, is one of the wisest people I've ever met in my life. And he had a way of articulating something, a problem or whatever, that just made you really understand it. And it was fascinating, and it was phenomenal. And I learned so much from him, whether it was one-on-one or whether he was talking to the organization. He just had a way of articulating it so that whatever it is, so that people really understood it. And it was great.
So I want to ask a little bit about you coming up through the company as an African-American female. And ultimately, I would imagine a lot of experiences that informed you being chief diversity officer. But in your career as a woman executive, as a Black female executive at the company, were there ever moments where, I don't know, that weren't the ideal experience, the sort of things you wanted to course correct once you became chief diversity officer?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of those. I mean, one of the things that, an example I would use is that if there's a race, and there's a race and there's a starting line, and I'm talking about a physical race, not like an ethnic race. I'm talking about on a racetrack kind of race, foot race. And if there's a race, and let's say that there's like, I don't know, 5-10 people on the race, and we're all lined up together, and everybody on that line has the same experiences from a work standpoint, the same capabilities, everything, and everything is equal. In that race, it's all the same, except on me, on the race, I'm wearing a backpack. And in my backpack, I carry being African-American in a country where that's been an unequal sort of environment for a very long time, 400 years to be exact. I carry my bag that I'm a woman, and particularly if everybody else in my race is, my race starting point is male, I have that in my backpack too. So I might have kids back there, I might have whatever in my backpack. So, but I have to run my race and still be as fast or faster than everybody else in the line who doesn't carry the backpack, weighing them down. And that's kind of what it's like in a career, in a corporate setting, is that we're running this race and I have to be just as good as everybody else, but I got a backpack on and they don't. So one of the things that as chief diversity officer always tried to do was to listen and understand who's got a backpack and try to lighten the backpack whenever I could. Now, you can only do so much because it's not just me, one person. Everybody's got to do their part, right? Everybody has to do their part. And I was proud of the fact as a company that we were able to craft a strategy that was global in nature, but it was only one step, a baby step. And there's lots of other steps that had to be taken. But, you know, at the end of the day, the company is made up of 100,000 people, and you want 100,000 people to be 100% effective every day. Yeah. And that means don't put false backpacks on people or empty them out or whatever. And that's the path. That's the journey. And it's not a one-shot deal. It's a journey. But it's an everyday journey that every single person has to live.
One thing, one of your firsts in the work was the first global diversity plan. I think there were pockets of great work happening in countries. And as someone whose parents are immigrants, I'm pretty much American, grew up here, went to school here, worked abroad a little bit, but what goes in the backpack for a Black female in the United States versus what goes in the backpack for someone that might be gay versus what goes in the backpack if you're Muslim or Jewish. How did you craft principles and programs around the different types of backpacks that people have, of the 100,000 people around the world for P&G?
Well, you're right, because it's different, right? So those backpacks are different in different countries. So one of the things we tried to do first was find something in common across all of our countries. And that was really tough. But what we landed was the thing that was in common was gender diversity. And that was the one thread that was common no matter where we went that we could focus on and we could start with, because then we could at least do something globally together that we could focus on. And then after that, then you can start to get into within the country, the uniqueness of the country and focus on that. But to start first globally with something that everybody could rally around with is when we started with gender diversity. And I think that that worked really well. And it also motivated people and gave people energy to then work on some of the other local issues that might be different from country to country, that are different from country to country. But starting there first with gender diversity, I think is what helped us do that.
Did you ever encounter any pushback? And not naming names, but more, I think the world's getting a little more woke, frankly. It's a weird word to use. But
no, I would say that.
What's that?
I understand the word, though.
Yeah. But at the same time, there's still pushback. There are people, not for any direct or conscious manner, but want to say, that's not my problem. Did you ever encounter that with executives, with country leaders, with functions, et cetera? And again, more importantly, what was the type of pushback and how did you kind of address it and push through that?
Well, oh, absolutely. It wasn't like it was everybody just, oh, yay, sign up. No, it wasn't like that at all. No, not at all. Some of it was, yeah, that's not my problem. I didn't get a lot of that. I got some of it. More of it was, but what about this or what about that? So everybody wanted their thing, so to speak, into it. So if we did that, then we would be doing everything, which means we would do nothing. So we couldn't do that. So really trying to sort of getting it focused and narrowed was probably the hardest thing to do. And then probably the other hardest thing was people then didn't know what to do. So, which is a lot of the case really now, is that some people just don't know what to do. I know there's a problem. I don't know what to do about it. I know there's a problem. I don't know what to say. Or how about I say nothing? Well, see, that's not okay.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
No, silence is being complicit in my book. So getting people, and back when I was doing this, it will be really interesting to do it sort of now, which is a very, like you said, woke time, so to speak.
We're in a more charged moment right now.
Very much so. Globally, which is really interesting. But back then, even getting the focus on the gender diversity was a really big deal. And I did find that in most cases, the executives were all highly supported, very supportive around the world. And that was huge. That was huge. And I saw huge changes in how they talked and how they listened, how they engaged and things like that. So that was a really big deal. When we created the Diversity Council, we had all the leaders from the different functions who were there and wanted to be there. And that was a good thing. Now, it was baby steps again, baby steps, inches. Still lots still needed to be done. But it was a start. And it was the first time we'd done that globally all together. But the biggest thing sometimes is I just don't know what to do. I just don't know what to do. I don't know what to say. And it's tough if you are the person, the recipient of it, so to speak, and having to be the one to call it out all the time. Particularly if let's say you're in a talent session and you're talking about people for either next assignments or promotions or whatever. And sometimes, a lot of times what would happen is the comment is, oh, well, this person isn't ready. Oh, this person needs that. And part of what has to happen is everybody sort of pushing back and say, why? Why do they need something else? You're putting a backpack on them, really. It's like, why? And that's a lot of what has to happen, but it has to happen constantly. And I think eventually, maybe we'll get there. But it's one of those things that it's an everyday sort of thing that has to keep going on. I don't know if that makes a lot of sense.
It does. I think something you also alluded to is it can't be just one person wearing the diversity hat with the diversity agenda, right? Everyone, because that's a lot of weight. And something I used to say when I was a young digital marketer was, we can't have a digital marketing strategy. We have to have a marketing strategy that has digital, right? And I think the same applies to diversity and inclusion. You can't have a diversity and inclusion strategy. You have to have a talent strategy where diversity and inclusion is at the heart of it. If it's this critical thing that's going to make or break the organization.
Exactly. Exactly. And there was enough research. There's enough research that says a more diverse organization is a better organization in terms
outperforms.
Of.
Yeah, absolutely. Performed,
absolutely. So why wouldn't you want to do that? Why wouldn't you want to do that? When I first took over, and I'm still in a conversation where I hear that there's a meeting and somebody in the meeting found out somebody else is gay, then they'll get up and leave the room. And I'm thinking like, what? Okay, think about that for a second. As an employee of the company who is also an owner, so to speak, of the company, we're not using our assets appropriately. You're just going to get up. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make business sense to me why you would do that. But people don't think about it that way, as opposed to we want every single person to be as effective as possible. So when you get up and leave the meeting because that person is gay, I got to tell you, you're not doing, as far as I'm concerned, the best for the company at that point.
Right, because you're not allowing the person to bring their whole self and be authentic.
Exactly.
You're forcing a backpack on them by walking
right
out of the room.
Right. And then everybody else in the room now is not effective either, right? Because you can't get done what you have to get done.
I want to shift gears a little bit to, I don't believe in work-life balance, but I mean, was there ever a moment when you took your foot off the gas pedal, or was it just always go, go, go?
I'll say, I don't know. See, when I had kids, I'll say later, I was in my early 30s when I had kids. So I had already been working for 10 years. So I was later. So my might be a little different, but I kind of go back to what I said earlier around knowing what's important when, because it does change. It changes every year. So what's important when you're 22 and working with single, no kids is very different than when you're 35, when you got kids that are playing sports or whatever. Very different. It might even be different when you're 50 and you've got an aging parent you're taking care of, which I had all of them. So that's really, really important. So when you say take your foot off the pedal, I think it depends on what that means. So for me, because I was a little older, like my kids always knew me as a working person. They always knew me as a person who traveled. So to them, it was nothing different necessarily. But I also made sure that there were things that I wouldn't compromise on. So my boys, I have two boys, and they were football players in high school. I don't miss football games. Nope, don't miss them. There's only 10. Okay, there's only 10. And I never did. I would fly all night to get back in time for a football game on a Friday night. And I tell people that's what I'm going back for because there's only 10. Now, luckily, they didn't play baseball, which is like 5,000 games a year. Okay, but there were only 10. And after 4 years, my older son, he made a comment about how he knew I was at every game. Because to me, that's what was important. That was important. The only other two times that I think I probably slowed down a little bit, and it wasn't for long, was the first time was more for health reasons. I actually had knee replacement surgery. And my physical therapy didn't go well at all. I mean, I was a bad patient, I guess, when it comes to, but I had serious scarring issues that sort of took me out of the game for a while. So I had to do things differently. So I was in physical therapy for a year. Most people only do that for 6 weeks, not me. No, I'm going at it for a whole year. So it really sort of set me back in terms of what I was thinking about, what I was doing and how I was working. And then probably the second time was when my husband passed away. So I took a little bit of time off, took a month off. And that's first time I'd ever really done anything like that. But I needed to for my kids and I needed to do for myself to be able to do that. But other than that, I was working before I had kids and they were part of my life and as my whole life as I think about it. So I didn't slow down. And I think I was a better parent. I am not one of those parents that I needed to be home every day with them. I would have been a crazy person. So for their health, it was better that I was working.
I like that you'd say whole life because it's this idea of balance is a tricky word. It's about integration, right? How one informs the other.
Well, and it's whatever your definition of balance is.
Absolutely.
Right?
So, absolutely.
I mean, I never said I did everything. I never said that. Never. Not once. But I would say I don't need to, if you know, when I got to the point I can afford somebody to pay somebody else to do laundry, you better believe I was paying somebody else to do laundry. I don't need to fold the towels. Those towels look just fine the way somebody else did it. But that allowed me then to come home and not fold towels, but instead play with my kids or whatever.
Yeah,
so it's all about, I think it's more about choices. It's about what choices do you make. And like I said, I never, ever said I'm going to do everything. I never wanted to do everything because I don't think that's possible. It's not possible. But it's all about choices and about which choices you make on what's important when. And I think that's what's most important.
It sounds like that was the kind of coaching you would give younger folks in your organization, because as mentioned, everyone has kids at different times, chooses to have kids, not have kids. You got a lot of young single people who are new hires. How did you coach people to think through this as they were entering these different life stages?
Well, just as I said, I coach people to focus on what's important and define really kind of, even when it comes to managing your family, what is most important. So for example, I knew people who, and this is funny, I knew people who could make the most fabulous of gingerbread men. I mean, those gingerbread men, I mean, they had tuxedos on and they were like, so when the kids, school party, whatever, they're showing up with 37 of these little dressed out gingerbread men. You know, I showed up from cookies from Kroger. Okay. So my kids and myself, perfectly happy, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But it's all about, okay, did you stay up all night and did your kid notice? I mean, and then is that really important? So at the end of the day, sort of what's most important, the fact that you were at the party or that you're at the party with 37 gingerbread men and tuxedos? Now, if that's your thing, okay, have at it. It wasn't mine.
Yeah.
And for mine, what was most important was being there. And I remember my younger son saying to me one time, we were in a car and I was driving him somewhere. I don't remember. And he said, and he was probably, he wasn't driving it, so he had to be like maybe 13, maybe 12, 13. And he said, you know, Mom, you do a lot. And I said, okay, here we go. Yeah, and sometimes you don't think that they pay attention, but they actually do pay attention. And he said, you do a lot. And I said, okay. He said, I think you should try to teach some other moms how to do like you. You do a lot because you do that good. You do that really well.
That's great.
Thank you. That was like my performance review. I appreciate that.
So what are you working on these days that has you the most excited?
So I retired to 35 years to the day. And I always said for my entire career, I wanted to do something different when I retired. And I mean different, the other side of my brain. So I said I was a dancer when I was growing up. My dad was a photographer. He had lots of different interests. He had a chemistry degree, he had a horticultural degree. He was a photographer, just all sorts of things. He was a teacher. And I used to think that was all crazy. Well, I actually became, and I am now, a professional sports photographer, believe it or not. And I have an absolute blast doing it. And it's because I think it uses the other side of my brain, which is the creative side of my brain, which from an IT standpoint, it sometimes can be very analytical. So you use that side of your brain a lot and you don't get to exercise the other side as much. I love the fact that I can exercise this other side of my brain with the technical side too. So photography has both sides of that. And it really has turned into me. And it was not anything I planned at all. Didn't plan it at all. I sort of fell into it because my kids, like I said, are athletes. And I ended up starting with taking pictures of them and I take pictures of other people and so forth. But that's really has me excited because I'm a learner. I'm a lifelong learner. So I love to learn. And it is not possible to learn all there is around photography. It is just not possible because there's always something new. That's the way technology is. And I use technology in everything, even when I was raising my family. I use technology. You're talking about that balance thing, that work-life balance thing, technology. I used it everywhere I possibly could. So technology, to me, is always about, there's always something new to learn. So I keep my hand in, not only from a photography standpoint, but just what's going on in the IT world. I still do. And I stay on top of that because that feeds my tech need because I'm still a geek at heart. I still do that. And if you can see now, the four computers I have on my desk that are all functioning, but that's a separate issue.
And the fifth one that's not functioning like your mom, right?
Yeah, exactly. Or the staff, you know, somewhere, whatever. But the point is that I love, love, love to learn. And I think the day I stop learning will be the day I die. Because I think that there's so much in the world that you can learn. And from a technology standpoint, there is no, it's infinite. It is absolutely infinite. So for me right now, I spend a lot of time doing sports photography and I love it. Love it, love it, love it.
So we talk about curiosity and learning and the sports photography that excites you. What concerns you? The world got really interesting most recently. What's keeping you up at night right now?
Well, it is such a weird, it's a weird world right now between a pandemic and what's going on around the racial injustice and equality movement, protests and so forth. It's just, it's a challenging to say is an understatement. And then when somebody says something about murder hornets, I'm like, come on, murder hornets, we can't take anymore. They're just not anymore. But what keeps me up at night isn't the pandemic so much as it is my son safe? And one of the stories I told actually not too long before I left, P&G was, in fact, I was given a talk with John Pepper actually that day. I can't remember who the group was we were talking to, but I remember it was being a bunch of women in the audience. It was like, I don't know, 100 women or so in the audience. And I said that when my sons started driving, 16 years old, whatever, is when I really became the most concerned about whether they would come home at night.
As a Black mother.
And not because of them getting in an accident. Right. It's because of they're going to get stopped by the police. And my younger son has been stopped twice. And let me preface this by saying he currently works for a summer internship. He's in college now. Works for a federal judge. That's his summer internship job. So you can see sort of the kind of kid that he is. And the first time he got stopped, it actually turned out okay. But what happened was, you know, he hadn't been driving very long, and he got stopped, and he was driving with his brights on the whole time. Not a good idea. But he got stopped, and the officer asked for his license or whatever, and it all went fine. But that's not what it was. What happened was when he came home, he came straight to my room and he said, "Mom, I got stopped." And my first reaction was, "Oh my God, but he's alive." That was my first reaction. My first reaction wasn't, "Okay, what did you do driving wise?" That wasn't what it was. It was
your backpack's different, Linda. Your backpack's
right.
Different.
Yes, it is very different. The second time, he was with three other friends, all white, really close friends of his. They were in an area of our neighborhood, and the kid that was driving, my son was in the back seat, got a text or a call or something from his mom. So he pulled over, which was the right thing to do, to respond via text to his mom. And then the cop pulled up, whatever, and said they'd had some drug activity in the area, whatever. But he made them get all out of the car. And there's so the four of them all got out of the car. He only patted one of the kids down, my son. Didn't pat the other three down at all. So that's an example of sort of what happened. So every single time one of my sons leaves the house, I mean, and they're 20 and 24, I worry. When my son was driving back to St. Louis, the first time going to a summer internship after being home because of the pandemic or whatever, for 5 hours, I held my breath that is he going to make it? And that's a serious backpack. That's a serious backpack to have. And I want to live in a world where you don't have that fear. That's what I want. But it's difficult sometimes for people to understand why that is and how that's like and how the world is that way.
Yeah, I think a lot of the conversations we're starting to have, a lot of the unrest we're seeing, I like to tell people that it's overdue. And I hope that we will continue to move more forward than backwards. But honestly, a lot of people in my generation feel relieved that this is happening, finally, right? People are waking up and having these conversations. But at the same time, we're aghast that we're not leading well right now. And I guess as a leader, someone who's led large organizations, has had your hand on the mic, what advice do you give our leaders right now? As a Black woman, as a mom of a 20 and a 24-year-old, someone who's made it by all accounts, what do you tell them if you're sitting across the table from them? What would you do if you had that magic wand right now?
Well, I'll tell you what I have told leaders, because I do participate in a couple of boards and so forth. And what I have said is that, and I've said this already, it's not okay to be quiet, because being quiet is being complicit, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. You also have to listen and really listen to what people are saying in terms of how their backpack, how that affects their lives. So listen, don't assume that you know. Don't ever assume that you know, because you don't. You know, you don't know. And then the third thing is that, which relates back to the first about being quiet, is you have to call out when you see it, when you see something wrong, see something, say something, right? But you have to call it out, even if it's not in your own backyard, even if it's not in your own company, you have to call it out. Because you have the ability to do that and call out other people. I also believe that today in this environment, we need leadership that is role modeling and saying the words that helps change our environment for the better. I don't believe that we have that right now in many fronts. I don't see the words, the behaviors, or the actions that are taking us to where we really need to be personally as a country. I don't see that. And that's both political as well as in other areas too. But it would be good to have that, because at the end of the day, that's what people do who lead. They lead, they make. In addition to decisions, their actions matter, their words matter. And people who are not thinking about what they say and what they do and the effects that they have on the people in their organizations or their cities or whatever, those are the people who are not good leaders to me. You have to think about how your words and your actions matter to people, because people look up to what you're doing and saying. You can even see it in the pandemic in terms of people's response to, should I wear a mask or not, or whatever. That's a perfect example of where your words and your actions matter. At the end of the day, wearing a mask helps everybody. It helps everybody. It's like wearing a seatbelt, right?
It doesn't matter how you look. It doesn't matter if it makes your dress wrinkled. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. And seatbelts save lives. Face masks save lives, right? So just wear the mask and put something fancy on it if you need to.
Okay? And set an example, right?
Set an example. Because also at the end of the day, our children pay attention. Our children look to what we are doing. Our children look to adults of all types to see sort of their role models, and we become role models for them. And if they see us acting, saying, doing, behaving, that's what they're going to do too.
Yeah. Someone once told me that leadership is time inefficient. And what that means is the amount of thoughtfulness and care we have to take to our actions and our words, right? Yeah, I fully agree. Well, Linda, I could talk to you all afternoon or morning, but I know we've got to wrap up soon. So I want to ask you three or four fun questions so people can get to know you even better than they already do now. What is something about you that surprises people when they find out?
Boy, that's a hard one. I think if it's somebody who doesn't know me, they may not know that I only wear Converse shoes.
Yeah, you're brand loyal.
I'm serious. I only wear Converse. I have for the last 8 years.
That's rad. That's awesome.
And I have I got to be in their top five customers, not 5%. I'm talking about top five. And it's actually started from a health reason. And it was because of my knees. And my doctor said he noticed that when I was wearing them, my knees weren't inflamed. I'm like, okay, that's all I need to know. And from then on, and my knees are better, my back feels better. So I don't own any other shoes at all. Really? Not really. So you'll see me at a black tie event with some blinged out Converse. So that's probably
That is so cool.
If you don't really know me, that's probably a thing you'll say, oh, well, those are nice. Well, that's all because I only wear Converse. That's why.
Are you more of a book, film, or a TV person?
I used to be a book person, digital book person. I love to learn, but I think I've become a YouTube person. Right. And to me, I think that's because if you know the movies, The Matrix, right?
Yeah.
And you remember how they would learn something really quick. They look at it.
Plug in, right.
Exactly. That's what I think YouTube is. I think it's the best thing on the planet. You can learn anything that you need to via YouTube, whatever. And so when I'm working out or whatever, I'm looking at YouTube videos, learning something usually, because there's so many people. And it created this medium that the everyday person could share. And it wasn't just these things over here. It sort of equalized that and normalized it. And I just think it's just phenomenal. So like I said, I spend a lot of my time looking at YouTube videos to learn things from other people. And I've always thought the people who know things are not always people who are deemed, quote, experts. Mm-hmm. It's the people down in the organization, too, who know so much. So from a YouTube standpoint, I think the average everyday person knows a lot. And that's who I learn from.
Who's someone out there that you would still want to get coffee with?
Probably. And I've met a lot of people in my life, and I've been really fortunate to be able to do that. Probably Oprah Winfrey. And it's more because I think, just as I said, like Robert Scott, I think is one of the wisest people I know. I think she learned so much over her years of doing a talk show. She's talked to so many people that she knows a lot and has such incredible instincts and has such a way of connecting with people. I would love to sit and just talk with her, because I think she would just be a fascinating person to talk to in terms of understanding even more about how she thinks about things and about how her mind works. I think she's just a fascinating person in general. I think she is.
Awesome. So kind of last question, what is one final piece of advice or a challenge that you would give to the next generation?
It's the same thing I would always say, which is knowing what's important. But I think for the next generation in particular, given where we are today, is that it's important for them to speak out, find your voice, and use your voice. And often people have a platform and don't use it. They have a voice and choose not to use it when so many people and so many things could benefit from them using that voice. I think that the next generation has an opportunity to do that differently and to use their platforms and their voices for good. And I already see that. They're already doing that. I think that's phenomenal that they're doing that and they keep doing that. Don't stand for things that they know not to be right. That's one of the things I always tell my kids. You always do what's right out of your commitments. And I think this generation is naturally doing that. They are insistent upon doing what's right, which is why I think there's so many protesting. I think that's why. And I think that's a phenomenal thing. So don't ever lose your voice. But at the end of the day, know what's important. Also know what you have control over, what you have influence over, and which you have no control over, none. Don't let it sort of stress you and wear you down. But again, go back to sort of what you can influence and what you can do. But actually, no matter what you do, no matter what it is you choose to do, do your absolute best at it. Because at the end of the day, one of the things I've always tried to do every single day, at the end of the day, look back over my day and say, did I do the absolute best I possibly could at whatever I chose to do today? Did I do my best at it? If I can say that, I sleep really, really well that night. If I didn't, then I need to do something differently. Mm-hmm. But for whatever I chose to do today, did I give it everything I have? Did I give it every single piece of energy I have? Did I engage in it? Did I do that? And if I can do that and do that every single day, then I'll feel good about sort of how I live my life. And I don't want to ever live my life with regrets. So that's the way I sort of think about it.
That is a great perspective and some great advice. Well, Linda, thank you so much for sharing your energy, your experience, and wisdom gained from your entire career and your constant curiosity. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's our show.
Like what you heard? Please subscribe, leave a review, and a 5-star rating on your favorite podcasting platform.
Now more than ever, people need to be hearing these stories. Please share our show with a friend or three.
Want to learn more or got something to share? Visit modmypod.com or email us, hi mom@modmypod.com.
You can also follow us on Instagram and Twitter @modminpod. We'd love to hear from you.
That's it for now. I've been Ramin Segal.
And I'm still Sharon Lee Tony.
Remember, we're all modern minorities out there.
We'll talk to you soon.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply.